IT, which let me know when you're rolling
in. Okay, we got it.
Okay, the three different activities that I'm aware of. First of all, there was a moving target team at Goddard, which met a few times, and estimates of how effective it was vary. That was succeeded by the project-level planetary target implementation team, which actually had TRW do a thorough study of SOGs and come back with some estimates of cost and everything. That was supported at project level, co-chaired by Harrington and Fuchel. And then there's the MTAG that John Clark is
I should not have misled you to think that I knew all that kind of history at the project level. What I primarily know about intimately is when my involvement started, which was starting with that POP review business, okay, and the results of the POP and Bob's. I knew there were things done to get to the stage where a plan could be presented, whether it was prioritized or not is not important. The fact that the plan was gotten together, I knew nothing how that happened. Okay, other than Bob Brown was intimately involved in making that happen.
So this would have been then the results of the PTIT and the results of the TRW taking a look at what
all
could be
coalesced
done.
Into a thing that Bob presented at the cost was in the POP review that nobody was there to present. And then Bob brought the whole thing up to Charlie after the POP review was over and after the budget was already sent out.
And when he brought it to Charlie, were you there, or were you present for that meeting?
I sure was.
And who else was there?
Frank Carr, Chuck Fuchel, David Crum, Charlie Pellerin, myself, Jim Welch.
Okay, you've got several people there who were supportive of planetary tracking.
That's correct.
Up to that point, that is, some of them had sponsored or allowed to happen, or even actively supported these various teams and the studies that they did. Did they defend it, or do you remember there any of them taking an active role?
Never got to that, Joe. This was not worked the way it should have been worked. Bob set up a meeting with Charlie without going through the project or informing other people he was doing it. I found out about it after the fact that it was set up. I think everybody else did. And frankly, that turns off a lot of support, just that kind of mode of doing business.
Excuse me, and I left my briefcase here.
Okay, and what happened was that what should have happened was that Bob worked his ideas. If Bob had come to Frank, Carr, and myself, showed me what he was going to present to Charlie, first thing we would have told him is go back and prioritize this. Don't come in with a $4 million price tag for apples and oranges and pomegranates. Okay, because there isn't $4 million in the system. We might be able to squeeze $1 million here or $1 million there, or $500,000 this year and $2 million next year, but we're not going to go and get $4 million lump sum in a budget that's already been locked up at the BEGS level. Right? That's just a fact of life. And if you were in a job long enough and knew the way the system works, the government system works, which is beyond our control. I mean, the budget goes every year. I mean, Congress has a lot of trouble getting a budget out on time, but we always have to get it to them on time. Right? Interesting. but it was locked up. Bob decided to come in and have his day in court with Charlie without taking advantage of what the other people could have done for him on this issue. Alright? He had a lot of potential allies, including myself. I did not support Bob in there. I supported planetary tracking, but I did not support the document and the cost that was presented to us that day. And Charlie didn't either. Bob had worked with myself and Frank. We could have had a little chat with Charlie before the meeting saying, hey, Bob's coming up with some ideas and I think we're going to try to do as much as we can. You know, sort of grease the slids. You've heard that term in line management. That was not done. And not only was it a bad meeting, but Charlie and Jim came out of that meeting incensed. I mean, they were really upset, to the point of almost yelling. And I think Jim Welch had a quote in there like, we're not going to support any of this stuff. I don't know what it was, so it shouldn't be quoted, but it was mm-hmm. something to that of that level. And because it was not well thought out of, you know, technically it was all good stuff, but it was not well thought out in terms of a presentation or a logic or a strategy. You know, there are good presentations that sell people and there are bad ones. Anybody in advertising knows that. And to be a good project scientist or program scientist, you have to have a little advertising in your blood. You know, when, how to sell it, when to sell it, you know, in what manner to sell it.
I guess that takes us back then to one issue that I'm still a little unclear of, and that is how Bob Brown was chosen as project.
He was the only one. We were debating whether to go out with an advertisement to hire a project scientist. The scientist in the system suggested to Charlie that nobody would ever apply. Nobody wants to work in Alabama, to be blunt. I mean, if you're working at Caltech, you want to go to Huntsville, Alabama. Be a bureaucrat for 2 or 3 or 4 years. Then one day, Ricardo called me up and said, hey, I've got a guy who might consider doing this for a couple of years. I said, who? He said, Bob Brown. Well, I had known Bob from previous experience with his, some occasion he did a presentation at Science Working Group. And, you know, everybody thought of him as fairly highly competent guy. Good scientist and all that. And I said, hey, that's not a bad idea. Let me bounce it off Charlie. I told Charlie. Charlie said, hey, that sounds all right. Let's do it. So we hired him as an IPA, interpersonal government act or something. It's a person who comes in from a place for 2 years on leave and then goes back. Mm-hmm. So that's how he was how he was hired.
I guess you also he's already reasonably well up to speed. On
working at the Institute, he had, for one thing, he knew most of the acronyms, which of course is the first 6 months of those. That saves 6 months of problems right there. You guys probably have gone through that problem. It's really hard because, you know, I don't want this whole thing to be a Bob Brown bashing session.
No, but I'm wondering how There doesn't seem to be in the government and in NASA a way of training people who have not been in government management positions who come in how to be effective.
That's right. The only way it can happen is if you come in at a low level and you observe the person you work for. For instance, when we usually bring in scientists at the GS 13 or 14 level to work under a branch chief who's a senior executive, right, scientist. After, you know, 6 months, a year of working under that person, just observing what's going on, the person starts to pick up a style and starts to notice what works and what doesn't work. So I think that's the only effective way people get, quote unquote, trained around here. Whereas when Bob went to Marshall, for instance, through no fault of his own, he went into the very senior level. He went in as a senior executive level person. There was nobody that he worked for. He had no idea. I mean, he'd never been exposed to government before. Never been exposed to a project like this. We've got complex interfaces, people interfaces. And you know, that it, you know, took him a long time to become effective. I mean, but let me say clearly, he was effective in many ways. You know, it's just this one issue of planetary tracking, I think, could have been handled a little better from a people point of view. And it just got out of hand. It blew up. It got people turned off. It got to the point where people felt they were being attacked from outside, personally attacked in letters written to their bosses.
Well, that brings us to the aftermath of the Pop Review, and that is presentation is made, it's not effective, it gets turned down. What was his reaction to that, and what was your reaction to that event?
There was no presentation of the in-depth details of planetary tracking from the Pop Review because Bob was not there.
Now, this is the second.
No, this is. I'm sorry. The meeting that he calls then after the POP review to appeal, but the budget is locked up with banks at that point.
Can you repeat your question? Now, you understand which meeting you're talking about.
He gets turned down in the meeting.
Cold. Yeah.
What was his reaction to that, and what was your reaction to that? Did you and he talk about it afterwards?
He was incensed, and I chatted with him after the meeting, and I explained to him why it happened. And I don't know what his reaction to our chat was, but I think he was personally offended. And frankly, I don't think he heard what I was telling him, because I told him exactly what I've been telling you guys. I said, Bob, we've got to prioritize these things and come in with various options. We can't get the whole package. There's no way, especially, and I tried to explain to him, hey, Charlie had no option today turning you down. He had to turn you down before you came in the room because the budget's dead. You know, it's gone. Okay, but at least you could have gotten sympathy to get this thing in a little bit this year, maybe more next year, and so on and so on and so on. But I think he was so upset that he didn't hear anywhere, because instead of everybody getting together after that meeting to clean up the debris, letters started coming in 2-3 weeks later on. You know, personally attacking Charlie Peller, which I thought was totally unfair. First of all, because Welch has got the prime responsibility for the budget, not Charlie. Charlie's only an advisor on the budget until we launch this thing. So, you know, saying blaming Charlie was wrong from the beginning. But, you know, how would you feel if all of a sudden letters start getting written to your boss personally attacking you from outside? You know, it doesn't make you more sympathetic to the whole issue.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there was a period of problem there. And the thing that ameliorated the whole thing was the Rosendahl meeting where Jeff suggested the MTAG and everybody went along with that. Well, I don't know if Bob went along with it. He was upset he wasn't on the MTAG. He was asked to be there as a consultant. But, you know, for obvious reasons. We wanted a group of non-politicians who were going to work the technical issues. All right. And that's what happened. And I think that's why the MTAD was very successful in coming up with some good conclusions that got almost immediate funding, immediate attention. That's an example of the way the thing should be done. You know, a specific example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, John Clark got the right people together, people that he knew, one, would be respected by the outside community, two, would be respected by inside NASA people, three, weren't politicians and, you know, going to get off on their stage and give speeches, and four, who had a commitment to get something accomplished. And, you know, it was done that way. The results of the MTAG filtered through Frank, filtered through Al Bogus at that time, filtered through me, got to Charlie with everybody saying, hey, this is a good compromise, we ought to do this, and it was done.
Now, Clark was at this point newer to government service.
John was given a lot of advice and the differences he took on how to run this thing.
Where did the advice come from?
From various people in management strain. Myself, Al Bogus, Frank Carr, Dave Skillman. He got a lot of help because we all wanted to see something happen. We didn't want another disaster. You know, frankly, he was given very strong advice not to put Bob Brown on the committee.
And he took that advice.
Well, he was young. He was like a sponge when it came to advice, because this was his first big responsibility as a new civil servant. And that was another thing. He had a goal to succeed. You know, so all the ingredients were there. And he had the right attitude to take advice. You know, he was smart enough to know that he was dealing with a behemoth in terms of a management structure, and you know, he was wise enough and not naive enough to think he knew it all and could do anything he wanted without help.
I was very struck more when you were talking about what had been done wrong. What I've heard about a review that was also given at Marshall in front of Hinners and Welsh.
Oh, you mean the famous A and B disaster?
That's right. Because this seems, again, a kind of cultural problem, in a way.
Bob, I forgot all about that. I'm almost sorry you brought it up, but that's another example of where two individuals, through no fault of their own, gave what was called the Stopet presentation on A and B, Peter Stockman and Bob Brown. And basically, they got up there. None of the STOCAT had seen any of this. You know, it had our label on it, but we had never seen it because we never allowed those kinds of charts and things to be said in front of Henners and Lucas. Even if they were true, there are better ways to do it. But they were insulting martial competence and engineering, talking about the philosophy of A and V, and that the philosophy is all wrong. It should be bottoms up instead of tops down and all this gobbledygook. And, you know, it just went over like a lead balloon. I mean, I've never seen Henner so mad. In the executive session afterward, he just laid into the scientist. You know, oh, God, was he upset. Henner's a pretty mild personality. Never seen him like that. And it was just an example of inflammatory things being said that wouldn't have been said if a few of us had a chance to recall. Even a Jim Westfall, who never worked in the government, said, hey, I would have never said that stuff. I mean, I could have gotten my point across without insulting everybody in the room.
See, what I've heard, there were some other people who were going to speak too, but after they'd seen this, they thought, Jesus, I'm not.
Jim Westfall was going to get up and speak. He said, no way. I'm not going to. I mean, he would have been lynched even if he said that. Even if he said the sun rises in the east. I mean, the mood of the group was just, oh God, that was a nightmare. I think that's the closest thing to a nightmare I've been through at Marshall in terms of a meeting. We just all wanted to get the hell out of there, you know, because it just went really from bad to worse. And one chart after the other. First chart would insult the engineers at Marshall. The second chart would insult the engineers at Lockheed, and of course Val Poline was in the audience too, and he got into a shouting match. And then Bob got up and gave this a treatise on philosophy of A and B. And you know, you've got people in there, you know, for better or worse, who have launched satellites, built satellites of all kinds and all colors, and they may know a little better what testing philosophy to do to get things off the ground than a scientist who's never worked on a project in his life. You know, I'm not so naive to think that I know better than Lockheed or more importantly, people like Gene Oliver as to what the right way is to test something. You know, we might be able to give them some ideas on how to enhance the testing, to do a throughput test, to do various other things that we had a major impact on. I mean, the scientists were heard, and they got a lot of things thrown into A and B, which everybody wanted to do, which were done, and which were very important. But to try to turn around the whole philosophy of a company, not to mention NASA, I mean, talking about spitting into a hurricane, I mean, you know, that's like spitting into a wind tunnel. It's just, you know, I guess that's the second example of... I don't know if it's ego or what, but you know, one person is not going to turn around a glacier, even if it's moving the wrong direction. You know, you can peck at it, you can chip at it. If you get enough of your friends chipping at it, you might make some impact on it. But one person is not going to accomplish something major like that. And I'm not sure, frankly, that if they had gotten their way, Bob and Pete, that A and B would have been better. In fact, it may have been a disaster. Because engineers are trained at companies and at Marshall how to test spacecraft, and despite Challenger, NASA has had some level of success launching successful spacecraft and testing successful spacecraft. And we certainly know Lockheed's had a lot of success at launching successful spacecraft, not necessarily for NASA. But that was as close to another, what day of the week was that? Maybe that was Black Tuesday or Wednesday. But that would be a good candidate for another Black Day of the Week. That was it. Actually, it's interesting you brought it up, because I would have never thought to use that as an example, because I mentally blocked that out of my mind, like as have many of the STOCAT members. That also led to the death of the STOCAT, if you're following all the history of the STOCAT. That was the key event which basically lost the STOCAT credibility, or began the process of the STOCAT declining as an important force in the system.
You've talked about some about the cultural differences between managers and people who come into the system from doing other things, from doing their own research in a sort of lone wolf way, or from a university where they're teaching or something like that. And it seems that managers expect information and options and choices to be presented to them with a certain amount of predictable ritual and in a certain type of format. And just thinking about some of the results of the Rogers Commission on Challenger and everything, there seems to that there might be a point at which the expectations of the managers to receive information in this way stops being the effective way to get decisions aired and starts to alter the information that comes into them by savvy people who want to bring up. They know what they can say, they know what they can't say.
I think, Joe, that's more a function of the personality of the manager you're presenting it to than it is necessarily on system, the management system. I can't speak for Challenger, because luckily I'm involved in it, but the people I deal with each has a different personality, obviously. And first let me say, I don't feel restricted from saying anything or bringing any issue up to any of the direct people I report to, namely Pellerin or Keller, and an advisory status with Welch. I do things in a different way depending on who I'm reporting to. But if I saw a Challenger situation coming up, like ST, that there is something so wrong that it's just going to be a national embarrassment to launch this thing, I and most other people I know in the system, at least in Code E, would not have any hesitation to take it all the way up to the top of NASA, and if that didn't work, take it to the Washington Post. I think what you're getting at, though, is that some people don't want to hear about problems. I don't think it's the fact that managers want to have things presented to them in a certain way and have options and all that. I think if you know that you're working for someone in the shuttle office who doesn't want to hear about problems, or you're working in a NASA center like Marshall or Johnson where it's practice not to keep headquarters in mushroom management style, feed them a lot of crap and keep them in the dark, you know. I think those are more elements of what you're getting at than the system of the way. Maybe I'm not understanding your question.
Well, I'm thinking about the fact that there are certain things you don't put on a view graphs in, even in ST.
Like what?
And there are certain things that you don't.
I'd be curious. What kind of thing would you not put on a view graphs?
Well,
or what kind of thing don't you think is put on view graphs?
How could Stopat have, in that meeting, brought up very serious and deeply held concerns about A and V and about the whole way that it was being managed?
Sure. Could have.
Could they have brought that up within the confines of not alienating everybody at the meeting?
At that point in time, Stopat was not unanimous on the feeling that A and V was a disaster. 2 years ago, Bob Less and the rest of the people who knew thought it was a disaster. But Bob Bless worked hard and pecked away at the glacier and got a lot of things changed long before that meeting took place. I think he still had concerns about how AMD was going to be handled, but I don't think it's fair to say that anybody thought it was the total disaster that Bob Brown thought it was going to be at that point in time. Now, history shows us AMD was a big success, so that tells us something who was right and who was wrong at the time. But I'd be the first to admit that without the pecking away at the glacier 2-3 years earlier by Westfall, by Bless, we would have never gotten to that point. You know, A and B might have been a disaster if the A and B we saw 3-4 years ago was the A and B that was held last year. Now then you could ask, well, 3 years ago could Bob Bless get up and say A and B is a disaster? He did. I was at Quarterly's where he did that. But calling it a disaster in a generic sense and saying it's a lack of planning and we have to do this, that, and that is one way of saying it's a disaster and getting your point across. Calling it a disaster and saying that Marshall and Lockheed are incompetent is another way of doing it. Bob didn't do it the latter way. Yeah. And that was the difference. I mean, I've been at meetings, closed meetings, where things on view graphs would probably startle you even after some of the view graphs you see. But this program, ever since his wife Thursley, but whatever, ever since Welch came on board and Keller came on board, has been quite open, at least in the closed meetings, if that makes any sense. But all of us feel a lot freer to say the king has no clothes. I mean, Al and I go around all the time talking about the disaster we've got in the advanced instruments program. And some things are actually finally starting to happen on that glacier. You know, we just had an M&R workshop, which almost looked like we set it up ourselves as scientists, but it was all engineers and managers, and one of their major conclusions was the replacement instrument program doesn't have anything to do with the need to maintain science, the level one spec to maintain science. Because you can't put instruments in 6 and 9 years after launch and expect to continue to do forefront science. Yeah. So that issue I'm beginning to have somewhere. I see some light at the end of the tunnel. Hopefully it's not another train coming. But
In the sense that the ASIs under the present schedule are not going to be ready.
They're not
going to
be ready.
You may wind up with a telescope with one instrument functioning for
exactly.
a certain number of years,
exactly.
if that.
Exactly the point. We've done it, you know, it's a typical Marshall philosophy. The history of the M&R program is simple. Marshall always looked at their role in M&R, even though they were overseer of all M&R. They always did an excellent job of maintaining a spacecraft in orbit. They did not consider the overall level one spec of maintaining a viable observatory in orbit, which is a very different thing. I'm confident today that that spacecraft will last 15 years. No question about it in my mind. It's clear we're not going to be doing science with 5 instruments over 15 years unless somebody triples our budget right now. I mean, look, the WIFTIC, I mean, we didn't build one backup instrument in the original plan. Now, why is it we expect gyros to fail and FGSs to fail and reaction wheels to fail, which are built in you know, large numbers and quantities? I mean, we've been building gyros, they're not one of a kind. Whereas we have 5 instruments, all one of a kind. For some reason, they're going to last forever. I mean, how this philosophy ever got started at Marshall is beyond me, but it's, you know, I don't know. Maybe that's a question I should ask Bob Lindell someday. He was down there in the early days. But for some reason, Marshall never took a serious look at what I call a systems science approach to M&R. And we see the result of it today. There's this group of 100 people who got together for the M&R workshop a couple of months ago gave a loud and resounding statement that the king has no clothes in this program. Your replacement instrument program schedule does not match your requirement of having a viable observatory. So, that's a long answer to your question, could we make a presentation where we really tell it like it is? But I think there are many examples where we have. It's just, goes back to my original comments much earlier, and that is, it's the way you do it. You know, and that's something I think is alien to most scientists who are brought up in universities and who haven't done anything but science. In a scientific paper, you're supposed to tell it like it is and come to a conclusion. If the conclusion is Joe Blow is wrong in his results, you say it. Alright? And, you know, who's going to... The worst thing that can happen is Joe Blow writes a paper two years later and says, you're full of crap, it's really this way. I mean, so you attack each other in the journals, but, you know, the average scientist isn't educated or it doesn't have the training or it doesn't have the experience to survive in this kind of environment unless something in his background has given him, I don't know where I'm going with this, but given him a philosophical or better yet, a human psychological type background where he knows how to deal with a lot of people. Like teaching would be at least a first start at this. You know, all you do is research and you're in worse shape. If you taught a lot of people, taught a lot of college students in your university, you might do better here. Even better yet, it would be if you managed a research group or wrote a lot of papers with 25 authors on them where you had to coordinate and make everybody happy. And it's almost like a human management type thing. It's probably more important here than your PhD in astronomy. I mean, I value, speaking from my own terms, the psychology courses I took in college and living in a fraternity house and being the vice president of that fraternity were much more applicable to my job here than astronomy. I mean, I have to have the card to carry in the PhD and all that, but, you know, that I can't underestimate enough the, and the teaching too, because I was a graduate assistant teacher for a while. The teaching, the fraternity experience, having to live with a group of people who are all egotistical, you know, just like myself, and the psychology background, much more important to a manager, a science manager, than the science itself. I mean, you got to have the science, obviously. But in terms of what I found most valuable, those are the things. It
seems as if the kind of ability to build coalitions is absolutely fundamental to what you do. In order that,
did you ever run for an election in a fraternity house? Now you're talking. No, that's most people think fraternities are a waste of time, and you know, ours was not one of the ones that, you know, kills people or threw them into the lake or whatever like that. But it was an experiment in human psychology, living together with a bunch of guys, and trying to run the house yourself. That's an invaluable experience. And it doesn't have to be a fraternity; it can be anything like that. But if a typical scientist stays in the dorms, perhaps, while he's in college, goes to graduate school, stays in his little cubicle doing his thesis, goes off to a university, and if he's lucky, doesn't have to teach, and stays in his little office and writes research papers. That's not exactly great life experience, then to be thrust into a system where if you can't get along with people and can't get your point across in a human sense, you're going to die miserably.
Also, the telescope seems not only quantitatively different to other kind of space science programs, but also qualitatively different, as if the very size adds more, just the overwhelming number. It's not maybe dealing with another four people, but somehow the structure of the thing seems to change because there are so many more people about. I don't know if I'm making any sense.
No, I think you are. I was just thinking about that. That's a good point, because space telescope is so big and because the science is so big in terms of the issues you run into, NASA really should consider the following. Whether the project's an Explorer or a Spartan or a space telescope, you have one program scientist and one project scientist. Al nor I can keep track of all the issues and take care of all the little problems that go on an everyday basis. I mean, you only tend to skim the cream of the problems. Yeah. If there were a project scientist and two assistants and a program scientist and maybe one assistant would be the right number, maybe this planetary tracking issue would have come up a long time before. Yeah. Maybe a lot of things would have come up a long time before. Yeah. But, that is a problem because, you know, I'm also a program scientist on EUVE, which is the Extreme Ultraviolet Explorer, which can be launched like in 1990. It's a $100 million class thing. I mean, that takes maybe a week of my time a year. You know, because there just aren't that many issues. It's a PI, single PI, single type of science. You know, there are issues, very important issues, but, you know, you don't have FGSs and power systems going bad and solar arrays and five different PIs and then you have an institute. There's no way this program is too big for one person and headquarters at one person. God, it's much too big. Yeah. And whether the program, as I said, is a $10 million Spartan or a $1 billion ST, you get the same kind of manpower on it.
What was the institute's attitude towards the planetary tracking problem? And how did that evolve as we got deeper into it?
Ricardo was a very good advocate and of planetary tracking in the early days while Bob was project scientist. If he did anything wrong, I think in front of two senior people sometimes he'd make comments like, we can't do anything. He even went so far as to say we couldn't take a picture of Jupiter, which is totally false. We could do that, you know. It doesn't take a lot of exposure time to get a shot of Jupiter. In fact, if it did, it would rotate, would smear anyway in rotation, so you're limited to very short exposure times in terms of taking pictures. As things evolved after the MTAG and we started to get software out and all that, there, an interesting thing developed. In fact, this was actually before the MTAC had reached its decisions, because this was before Challenger, and I remember a big issue with some of the planetary scientists on the SWG, especially Caldwell, was Ricardo was saying, hey, we're not going to be able to incorporate your software in time for launch, even if you get it in.
This
for
is
planetary.
I remember one October Science Working Group.
That's the one where Ricardo basically got up and said, we can't make it, and then Frank Carr got up and said, oh, you're the only one throwing in the towel, Ricardo. And then Ricardo apologized in executive session, you weren't there, but he his people basically jumped all over him at lunchtime and said, oh, you can't say that. And so Ricardo made a formal apology to the group. Yeah, that meeting was at the Institute. So, and planetary tracking was part of that. And, you know, then it became a question. I kept asking Caldwell, you know, you better talk to Ricardo because, you know, we're paying all this money to get these capabilities, and Ricardo's saying they're not high priority within the Institute. So what's going on here? You know, well, what Ricardo was doing as a good manager, he knew planetary tracking was a high priority thing and had high visibility. And by saying he didn't have enough manpower and time to do it, that was another way of getting more manpower and more money from NASA. I mean, yeah, it's a game. You know, it's the Washington Monument game played in Baltimore. I mean, he wouldn't tell us he didn't have enough manpower and time to do some 14th level correction to SOGS that doesn't affect anybody, because he'd never get the money for it. But saying he wasn't going to have manpower and time to do planetary tracking, now that got people's attention. Except the people dealing with him or worked with him a long time and also knew he plays this game very effectively. So, but everybody, I mean, everybody does it at any level, so that's not a shot at Ricardo.
The whole issue, one of the issues that has gone on in planetary tracking has been the question, is it delivering what was promised or is it an enhancement?
I think it's both.
To a particular capability.
I think it's both, Joe, and that's one of the most difficult things to separate the wheat and chaff from this whole thing. You know, there's no question that the NAIF and the other couple things that are going to be done to the real-time system that came out of the MTAC had to be done to meet level one specs. And some of the other littler things that are going to be happening over the next 2 years, 3 years, are also things we need to do level one, to meet level one specs, both the spirit and the fact of level one specs. You know, at some point, though, there's some things thrown in there that are niceties to have, and they are things that you would not get if you went to a ground-based telescope and wanted to observe a volcano on Io. You'd probably go in there, you'd probably have to do some real-time calculations on your little portable computer or calculator or whatever. And really, and I think I'm being fair here, if you look at all the things that are included at every level in the package for planetary tracking, there is some level of some of those niceties. Yeah. And that's the one remaining thing that has to be done by the MTAC, is to really take a second look at the second order things, the ones that weren't funded by that $2 million I talked about earlier, and really try to pull out once again the wheat and the chaff, second order wheat, but really try to dig out the chaff and say, hey, you know, it'd be nice to have this capability to calculate whatever on this moon at this time. But frankly, that's something the observer could do at home before he comes. You know, I'm not giving you a very specific example because there's too many things. So to answer your question in summary, the current list of desires, planetary tracking, if all enacted, will certainly meet level one specs, spirit and facts. But there are still some things, in my opinion, that are really hampering the observer too much. I hate to say that as a scientist representing scientists, but ST should serve astronomers better than any other telescope in the world. On the other hand, it shouldn't make them lazy. I mean, most astronomers are used to doing something other than being given their data on a silver platter.
The question, there seem to be, or let's say some people thought that there was reluctance to allow real-time interaction with an observation.
Yeah.
Was that ever that?
Well, there's a reluctance among many operations people to ever do anything real-time, because every time you do it, there's a danger of sending back a man. I don't think they're, you know, at the gut level and the serious level that anybody ever wanted to eliminate the possibility of doing real-time acquisitions. So we need that more than just for planetary. We need it for galaxies, where you want an image of a galaxy with the width pick out an H2 region and put a slit on it. You know, so you have to have that capability, whether you're doing planets or, you know, other kinds of science. So, you know, there might have been somebody in the system who wanted to eliminate that possibility, but I don't think anybody seriously and who had any authority was ever that bent over against, you know, real-time. It's also a level one spec that we can do real-time observations. So it may be slow in coming because they're going to be the most difficult things to do. And regrettably, a lot of planetary science needs to be done real-time. But to be fair to the system, we're in low Earth orbit, and it's going to take us a while to use that system in an automated mode to give us the confidence we understand it before we start jockeying around the spacecraft in real-time. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't make sense to do your more feisty observations early in the program. You're going to walk, as Frank Carr would often say, will always say, you've got to walk before you run in operations. And real time is running, and automated is walking. Yeah. So.
Did you have anybody that you could rely on for good advice on the specifics of what was a nice to have or what was an essential to have in planetary science?
Throughout this whole thing, I talked to people like Paul Feldman, Warren Moose, John Caldwell, Westfall, who people forget does work on planets occasionally. He is a geologist after all. So I felt I had a cadre of people that I could rely on, and you know, a lot of my advice came from Jim Westfall, Warren Moose, people like that. People who have actually done planetary science. There are two classes of planetary astronomers. Those that will use ST but have never bothered to ever use IUE or OAO, so all they've ever done is ground-based planetary astronomy. And then there's people who have used IUE and OAO and know what it's like to do planetary science in space. Okay. I tended to rely on the latter.
Mm-hmm. How about Lonnie Lane?
I know Lonnie, but I don't... he's another person I could have called. I just don't know him as well as the other people. But he falls into that latter category, too. Lonnie's very good.
Some of these questions, as they came up and the concerns when the letters started to come in, Bill Brunk would still have been here at about that time. Did you have much interaction with
Bill
with
was
Brunk
still,
on the planet?
Shut this thing down in a matter of days. Shut down the controversy that is. Because Bill was an experienced guy with his community, and Bill was here for the 9 years I've been here, and we knew each other very well and worked very well together. Frankly, I don't even know who to go to in the planetary division who represents this area. I know there's Jürgen Rahi and Henry Grinton, but I'm never sure who does what, because they sort of split Bill's responsibilities. You know, so that would have been a help. That's a good point. If Bill was here, I think the thing could have been handled, the controversy could have been eased a bit, quite a bit earlier.
One other question that I did want to ask
maybe
you
just
about.
If I just